Welcome to the We Love Arabian Horses podcast, sponsored by Markel, the insurance with horse sense. I bet you were expecting to hear the second half of Christine Jamar's interview today. Well, don't worry, we still have that for you next week. But it's not very often that we have the opportunity to interview the breeder of a newly crowned world champion, and we had the opportunity to do that and wanted to share it with you as quickly as we could. So please enjoy and welcome me in congratulating Ted Carson, breeder of the newly crowned world champion stallion, Alexander.
Hello, everybody. This is Paul Costell with the We Love Arabian Horses podcast, and today we're joined by Ted Carson with Ted Carson Arabians. Ted, how are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Paul.
Well, listen, we want to talk to you a little bit about this big win that you had, the wins that you had at the Big Paris show that just ended. But we want to also talk about you and your breeding program and what kind of led to this most recent victory and victories. Tell us a little bit about the weekend in Paris and the World Championship show and what happened there with Alexander and the other horse as well.
Well, for us to be able to bred a world champion stallion is for sure an honor and a dream, and we're proud and all those things. But it took a lot of people and breeders and all that to get to that point. But not only did Alexander go world champion stallion, but we also had bred another colt on the same year, which his name is Exalt. And he produced the yearling world champion colt from this year named Baz Aljismia. And then also, Excalibur was their both of their sires. And Excalibur was then Servant World Champion. So for us it was like our whole line was sitting right there in front of us after 25 years of work and had an amazing weekend.
Well, I know for the breeders who listen to our podcast and others that are Arabian horse enthusiasts around the world, you know, watching the decades of work to come into the culmination of such a big, not only win for one, but you had several wins at this big event is just amazing. You know, tell us a little bit about the weekend and how much fun that was and just, you know, the excitement.
Well, of course, you know, Paris itself is probably the most you can't be overdressed in Paris. That's what's, kind of amazing about that show. I mean, you can just lay it out there, and that's what's great about that particular show, where I think all the other shows have kind of lost some of that appeal to it. You know, everyone kind of seems a little bit more relaxed and casual, and that's what's so incredible about that particular show. And the other thing is the energy of it and the way people, you know, hold the world championship. It's a high honor and it's the highest honor. So the other thing I think too that makes the world championship so interesting is that it is the world championship. So it's, you know, the horses that were bred here in the U.S. have to go over there and compete in another world and in another idea of what they think that, you know, the sure. ideal Arabian horse is. And so that's what makes it so interesting that the world can kind of come together and come up with a world champion. It's not easy to do.
Well, I want to give you personal congratulations from me and the entire community for these big wins. I think it is a milestone that many people would like to achieve one day. And so kudos and congratulations to you and your family.
Thank you very much.
Let's go back, though, a couple decades, and let's start with first how you found Arabians and what was your original passion for Arabians? What got you interested?
Well, I grew up right next door to Donnie and Shorty Boggs, which was the mother and father of Bobby Boggs and David Boggs. Of course, big, you know, part of the industry for many years.
Sure.
So I kind of like, since I was a child, I, you know, saw them breeding horses, and it just became a part of what I, you know, even at a young age, 10, 12 years old, I was kind of headed there mentally. And when I started showing horses, probably about 13 years old, you know, I was well on my way mentally that's what I wanted to do.
Right. So you immediately connected to the horse and they happened to be next door, and that was just a very lucky place to be connected.
Well, that's true. I was lucky to be there, and I've always loved agriculture. And so, you know, it just happened that I think that, you know, by chance, I grew up next door to one of the, you know, best young breeders or the best breeders in Minnesota at the time. And they were getting also a lot of attention. And so, you know, I guess I think, you know, fate or how you want to call it, you know, that's where I grew up. And that's what kind of started my love of it.
Well, that's fantastic. And, you know, we interview a lot of folks about Arabian horses and their passion. And everybody's story is almost the same, but some different version of the same thing. They found it one way or another, and it just kind of took over like the Zen, like fate.
No, that's it. I mean, it's infectious, and it's, you know, it's a lot of things, you know, emotionally the horses are. And I think that's why, you know, people, once they get it in them, they just, it sticks, because it's not only infectious, but it's also has, it's just a lot of emotions can be wrapped up in it. And it's also hard, you know, tough emotions with it, because there is some heartbreak in breeding horses.
Sure. Well, let's talk about when you first opened your public facility. How old were you when that happened?
Well, it was, you know, of course I've been training for over 35 years, but what happened is I met the Butlers back about 25 years ago, and they, you know, kind of opened their doors to let me come into their facility. And that's when I kind of started my own breeding program. I wasn't working for anybody. And that's when I was really able to, you know, start forming my own idea and vision of what I was trying to accomplish. So it started, you know, roughly 25 years ago that I started breeding my own horses.
Well, and at that time, did you know what you wanted to do? Or I'm sure over time, you know, the vision, you know, morphs itself a little bit. How did that happen?
Well, it does. But, you know, the one thing I always stuck with is this. I loved two things. I loved beauty and the beautiful eyes and nostrils and all of that, with large tail carriage and presence. I mean, that was my, you know, bell ringer. I just, you know, I was infatuated with that idea of a horse. And so for me, you know, I was always headed that direction. I mean, it started there. So
right.
It was pretty, yeah, as far as the vision goes, it was always right there. And of course, it changed a little bit here and there, realizing some of the things I needed to bring into the breeding, you know, no doubt.
So you had a public facility, but you were also breeding your own horses along the way. And that has been what culminated this past weekend in essentially decades of breeding, yes?
Well, it's true. But, you know, one thing I got to say is this, is that, you know, I'm kind of taking a lot of the credit for it. But what happens over the years is that each horse in the pedigree, you can have, you know, have you have a story for it and how the owners, you know, got to that point. And I kind of more had of a cooperative in a sense. I mean, I had a lot of small breeders. It wasn't just one big breeder. I had a lot of small breeders that really embraced what we were doing. And we were able to, through multiple breeders, we were able to, you know, culminate in you know, achieve the horses that we wanted. Of course, we would breed many and keep the few mares that we always wanted. But the pedigree itself is a great story, actually, in almost every horse.
So let's skip real quick to where are you located now and how long have you been there?
Well, we relocated 4 years ago to Allgood, Alabama, which is just north of Birmingham, north side of Alabama. We kind of made our slogan Allgood because of the town we live in. And
yep.
It stuck with a lot of people. It's kind of a catchy tune, you know. And when we travel the world, people, you know, actually say Allgood as a question, you know. And so it's kind of been fun to have that as our in our logo. And I think it caught on pretty quick, actually.
Well, that's fantastic. And so when you transferred, you brought your breeding program with you, and that's what you've been continuing now for what, 20 years or so?
That's right. We're about 25 years into our own breeding. And, you know, how we really, another thing that I'm going to just step back 1 second. The reason why I really also stepped in more into the breeding idea and that we wanted to produce a certain thing was because what happened is we bought a couple horses and they won some big prizes and they lost some big prizes. And mostly Padron, which was one of our first herd sires, was one of those. And what happened for me, it wasn't enough to just buy a horse and win and lose. I didn't know if I saw the benefit in just buying a horse, winning some big prizes, losing some big prizes that were kind of disheartening, and with that horse. And what I realized, I was like, you know, if I'm going to do this for a really long time, I need to have a larger impact of and a little deeper, you know, grained into this deal than just buy a horse and win or lose, you know. And so
right.
That's really how it kind of – it got me motivated to, you know, produce our own idea of what we thought, you know, the Arabian ideal was.
Well, and I think that's fairly significant. A lot of professional trainers – only focus on the professional training side or the buying and selling side, and you really incorporated breeding early on, it sounds like.
It was, no question. And all the farmers prior to that I was at, they were also involved in breeding. So I got to see a lot of families do certain things, and so I kind of had a, you know, my eyes were open all those years of working for other farms. And so breeding became, you know, almost yes, training is a huge part of our deal, but breeding and breeding horses and having a product that moves forward into the future and all those things, it's been all of us. I mean, it's been every day of our life. You know, we haven't looked back.
Yeah. Well, I think the aspects of breeding are so important, and when we do our podcast with breeders, we really like to focus on some tips for breeders. So, along the way, were there things that you did that you think were really special that you could share, or things that you did that didn't work out so well, like the traps that you got into that you wanted to avoid? Can you make any suggestions?
Well, if you don't mind, I kind of like to just kind of talk about how the pedigree came about, you know? Like, so for instance, on Alexander, who was just world champion stallion, you know, his mother was a mostly padrone daughter. And so we ended up with mostly padrone. We bought him at 6 months old. It was a partnership or a syndicate that bought him, and we kind of made him our first breeding stallion. Then at that same time, so he was by padrone Psyche out of a padrone daughter. And then what happened at that same moment, padrone Psyche was being bred to Bay Shaw daughters and having lots of successes, and they were doing a lot of winning in the arena. And so my idea was to take, at that time, Falcon daughters, who was double Bay Shaw, and breed, you know, kind of a hyper vigor or whatever, to a double padrone, to a double Falcon, to a double Bay Shaw, and come up with our product. And so that was kind of my first idea of where that pedigree began for Alexander. And so what we were doing is we weren't buying expensive mares. We were buying mares, you know, somewhere from 7,000 to 50,000 maybe at the most. At that moment, and we were, you know, that was our idea, take that double padrone, take that double Bay Shaw, and make a hyper vigor of a breeding animal. And out of that came Alexander's mother, AR Most Irresistible. So anyways, that's kind of how that pedigree formed, at that moment. But of course, the pedigree takes years and years and years to move forward and end up being what it is. So kind of, there was another horse in between named SF Faraz with my pedigrees, but to kind of follow with Alexander's pedigree, what happened is I knew I needed another version of Pretty that I didn't have,
right,
that I wasn't getting in the U.S. And so I kind of went on about a six-month or a year overseas travel. And I was going to every show, and we were spending money we didn't have at that moment. And I was going to figure out how I was going to get the next, you know, type of horse that I was really needing. And how that came about was this, is that I saw a horse named Shanghai, or they, you know, the breeder would call him Shanghai EA. He was a Justice son. And I saw him as a yearling at the World Championships in Paris. And when I saw him as a yearling, I decided that moment that was the horse I wanted for our next blood to come forward. So in the means of that, we ended up, you know, representing Shanghai here in the U.S. and with that breeder, and we're so thankful for Albert Soraka that allowed us to do that. And then with that, you know, trying to promote the Shanghai semen in the U.S., we brought over with Albert Soraka, the breeder, Excalibur EA as a yearling. And that's how that pedigree began. It was all because, you know, I fell in love with the Shanghai EA, which was then the father of Excalibur. And Excalibur's part of the story this year's Paris. He was Silver World Champion. He was the sire of Alexander. And he was also the sire of Exalt, who produced the World Champion Yearling Colt. So that's kind of how that pedigree formed. And it took us 25 years to go there.
Well, that's amazing. So what about that horse when you saw him as a yearling in Paris? What about him struck you so significantly?
Well, I was looking for two things. I was looking for a super refined, and when you start talking about pretty, let's say, for instance, I was looking for a super refined bone in the muzzle area. So I was looking for shorter heads and a really refined bone, you know, from the eyes down to the muzzle.
Sure.
And that horse was incredible. I mean, I think he's still one of the best as far as that goes. And his pedigree continues to be that way in a lot of different forms. But I was looking for that, and I was looking for that instant, you know, carriage, tail carriage, and real type line. And when I say the type line, what I was looking for is I was looking for this kind of beauty without a major fault. And I felt like that horse really hit it for me.
That's interesting. So beauty without a major fault, and the simplicity of that is pretty significant.
Well, it is. When you breed horses and you have a fault, it can either take years and years and years and years to breed it out, or you never breed it out. And that's been kind of one of my goals in breeding. I don't want to just breed for this one piece knowing I can get three more bad pieces that come with it. And so I've always been about breeding a complete horse. I've never been about, just breeding for a beautiful head or a great neck and I get, you know, three bad, faults that come with it. That's not how I bred. I want this one particular piece without anything that's going to really hurt us. And when we get that piece, those are the mares we kept.
Gotcha. So when you're looking for those faults to be excluded, it's best to not have them there to start with. You'd rather start with a horse that doesn't have those big faults because they're almost impossible to get rid of.
Well, that's how I believe. And so, like, for instance, let's go back to Alexander. So what I got from the Falcon line, which was the Bayshaw, was you know, they had these amazing attitudes. This particular Falcon mare was very refined in the muzzle. I liked that about her, but she had some faults about her. We bought her very reasonable. I think it was like $7,500. And then mostly Padrone gave us this amazing courage and strength with great movement, great tail carriage, a beautiful big nostril, and a beautiful big dark eye. I mean, that's the things he gave us. And when we got that in a mare, those are the mares we kept.
Gotcha.
And then when we brought in the Excalibur and Shanghai, what they gave us was they gave us also that beautiful type overall, but they gave us that beautiful, soft, boned muzzle. And it was the culmination of all those pieces, you know, over 20 years that got us into that.
Well, I think about it from what you're saying and my own experiences. It's the beauty and the conformational, you know, accuracy, quality, combined with this charisma and then athleticism as well. I mean, that's a big bundle of things that have to happen to have the horse come out the other end with all those major pieces.
Well, absolutely. On top of it, like you're saying, to end up with the good pieces without something so bad to make you not, even able to be world champion, that's a really hard thing to do as a breeder. And so to have, one horse, what was interesting too about Alexander is that, he was always very beautiful, very beautiful. And we got him weaned, we got him in the barn. I took a small video of him. And we went to U.S. Nationals, and I sold him as a weanling to Allstate Stud. And I came home from U.S. Nationals, and I started working. The first day I was trotting him out in the arena, which I do a lot of. I trot, and I stand up. I work all parts of that. And I trotted him. I came in from there, and I said, Brandy, I think we just sold the world champion. and he was not in very good condition, but I felt it. I mean, he was spectacular on a lead. And still today, he was exuding that in the arena.
Interesting. I mean, you can see it even at that young age.
I saw it the day I put him on a lead and trotted him in the arena as a workout. I knew he was going to be world champion.
That's amazing. What about some of these faults or suggestions you could make to breeders about what to do or not to do? Were there any big moments you had in your 20-something years of breeding?
Well, I always kind of, I like the scorecard as, I was always a proponent of the scorecard because let's say, for instance, we teach this at the judges school. If you start at a 17 and you like some things and you work up the scorecard and you start giving 18, 19, 20s, or you work down the scorecard because you have some faults there, here's the problem is that if you're starting at 17 as your average, and you have a piece on your per piece in your horse, let's say, for instance, the body, and you could score that body, you're like, oh, it's not even a 17. It's really a 15.5 or a 16.
Right.
If you're working down, that is a fault that's going to be hard to breed out.
Right.
And so that's how that scorecard can help, especially a novice breeder, because if you're working down that scorecard, those are faults, and they are hard to breed out. It takes generations to get it out sometimes, or maybe never.
Well, and when you're judging these major shows, a half-point difference is a significant loss. When you lose a point or two on a major fault, it's going to not give you a chance to be up there in the top circle.
No, that's right. And so that's why I kind of mentioned earlier here, is that I always bred for a complete horse. And so for instance, I refer to Exalt, and he was the sire of this world champion that was just world champion here in Paris this year. And what I always call, and what's funny too, is that Exalt and Alexander were born on the first year at our farm, or they were born on the same year at our farm.
Oh,
and,
the new
and,
farm.
No, not on a new farm, back when we were in North Carolina at Butler Farms.
Oh, wow.
And they were the first full cop of Excalibur EA, and Alexander was the first Excalibur baby ever born, and I think Exalt was probably one of the last of the full crop that year, and they were both born on the same year, and now both very important sires and horses in the world.
Well, I think that's an amazing story, and I love hearing literally decades of breeding that culminated in this wonderful win, but it also has produced a number of great champions for you over the years, and they just keep getting better and better and better. What do you foresee in the short-term future in your breeding program?
Well, so for us, what's exciting is two things. We have a new kind of adventure that we're doing. We bred a colt named Olga Davici that is kind of, leaning towards the Western world. Right now, he's in training to go to Scottsdale for a Western horse. But the Western breeders are really embracing him, and that's what's important. If I say, oh, he's a great Western horse, okay, fine, and or he can go win a prize, fine. But the difference what's happening is that the Western breeders have already embraced him. And so what I mean by that is that he's 3 years old. His first year he bred, I think, maybe 10 mares, 9 mares, something like that. His three-year-old year he bred 21 mares. And you can see people already, the breeders are really watching them right now to see if that's going to be their next year's selection for them. So I think that's super exciting for us. It's a new venture we haven't really done, meaning a performance sire. But that performance sire, Olga Davici, that we feel is going to be a really big part of the industry, he comes from our halter pedigrees. We feel really strongly about that he's going to have a nice stamp in the world. The second horse that I think is really interesting is a horse that his name is El Moustique, and he's a yearling bred by Joel DeMartu. And he is by a horse named FLA El Rashim, and he's out of an Exalt daughter, which is also part of our pedigree. So we feel really, and so I think this is a horse that is, he's kind of like the modern day Fame VF. I think he can be a horse that produces halter horses in the U.S. I think he can produce breeding in hand horses in the rest of the world, Europe and the Middle East. And I think he's confirmationally so good that I think he can produce the performance horse that, you know, that we all enjoy here in this country.
Well, a minute ago you touched on, you know, the horses and the Western Pleasure, for example. Me having shown a horse who was national champion in the Western division but had also been a national champion in halter, I think it's so important for us as a breed, as we continue to breed for athleticism and beauty, both in the halter arena and the breeding arena, plus in the performance arena. Talk a little bit about that, because many of these horses that you're talking about will be able to do both.
Well, that's absolutely correct. So, like, for instance, I'm going to talk about All Good Avicii's pedigree. So the grandma, we bought the great-grandmother, which was a Falcon daughter. We then bred to mostly Padrone, which gives us our grandmother. And then we bred to another stallion of ours that we embraced and we were so lucky to have, a horse named SF Veraz, which owned by Patty Shire and bred by Patty Shire at the time. And so he became embraced by not only the halter group and the breeding group, but he also got embraced by the riding breeders and owners. So she became the grandmother, or the mother of this All Good Avicii. And then we bred to KM Bugatti, who we've got in the barn, who is also, you know, a halter producer and a performance producer. In fact, he's one of the leading sires in, you know, in the last 3, 4, or 5 years.
Sure.
He's the leading sire in all the arenas, it seems like. So the pedigree itself is, you know, has been embraced by the performance people. And he's also beautiful enough. This horse, All Good Avicii, was champion at Scottsdale, champion at Region 12. He was reserve champion at the Midsummer Nationals. And so he's done a fair amount of winning in the halter arena. But he's, you know, but his mentality and his quality and all these things are really, you know, looking favorable for him in the Western arena.
Well, and I think when you talk about the performance piece of this, the beauty of the horse certainly has a significant impact when you're talking showing at a major show like Scottsdale or U.S. Nationals. But the athleticism is so critical to be part of that, and that they're good movers. Talk a little bit about movement and the importance of movement.
Well, you know, the whole movement thing is you know, there's always the discussion of form to function. And I really not, you know, was never sure what that meant necessarily, because it seems to me that every division now has kind of their own pedigree, so to speak. And so, you know, a lot of times you're not going to see the same form to function in one way you are or the other. But they still have to be conformationally sound. And that still goes back to in-hand breeding, which is what I've always loved and adored and really worked towards. And I feel like because I've bred a complete horse all my life and I've never just given up faults here or there, that we've been able to produce a riding horse along with our beauty. So movement, you know, is huge. I mean, like, for instance, I mean, this young colt coming up, All Good Avicii, his hip is long and deep and, you know, he drives up underneath himself. And so that in itself is going to allow him to, you know, slow down and do what they're asking the Western Pleasure horse to do nowadays. You know, a shoulder, an amazing shoulder and neck, which he does have an amazing, you know, actually it's over and above amazing. It gives him the flexibility through the necks and through the shoulders to lift up and the joints move and things like that. So
sure,
it really still comes down to conformation. I mean, they've got to have the proper pieces and parts to be able to do, you know, what we're asking them to do these days.
Well, and I think you made a good point a minute ago about the English Pleasure conformation horse might be different than the Western Pleasure conformation. One's a little more upright and the other's a little more horizontal. But either way, the conformation is still sound and bold to that particular division.
And that's right. And so what happens when you have horses that aren't conformationally quite correct, they may be able to do a job for a certain period of time, but I think their careers are short, and that's the problem with breeding with some of these major faults, is that their lives are shortened in their careers because, you know, they're just, it's not conformationally sound enough to keep doing it. And so a lot of times horses can get by with it for a little bit, but it's hard for them to do it for a lifetime anyway.
Well, Ted, we could talk to you for hours, and I really appreciate this amount of time with us. I want to say thank you for being a member of the EEC of the Arabian Horse Association on the Education Evaluation Panel, which is what licenses our judges. I think the education of our judges is so critical, and I appreciate the time you've committed to that endeavor for, I think, about 5 or 6 years now. That's very, very important. And also just congratulations to the culmination of this major breeding program for decades. And me and the We Love Raving Horses community just send our kudos and congrats to you and your family for this wonderful success.
I really appreciate you having us on there. It's kind of fun to be able to talk about it. So I really appreciate the time, definitely.
Well, Ted, if anyone wants to reach out to you, what's a good email address for them to contact you?
Ted@tedcarson.com.
Well, that's simple enough. Really appreciate your time again today. Ted@tedcarson.com. If any of you want to reach out to Ted, I'm sure he'd be happy to chat with you. And again, thank you for your time, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Hey, this is Austin, director of the We Love Arabian Horses podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any ideas, comments, feedback, you can send me an email at austin@wearabianhorses.com. Or you can just contact us through our website, wearabianhorses.com. Make sure to come back next week to hear the remainder of Christine Jamar's interview with Scott Benjamin. I'll see you soon.